I'm completely new, and I would say, okay, what when you say let's start about macro, what are you talking about?
So it's a fair point. So I guess the logic is that, you know, obviously investments are all complicated by the way that different actors, different participants look at individual markets, right? So there are what have been deemed to be macro players, and there are people who obviously, and they don't call them micro, look at things which are much closer to the individual opportunities, investments, securities, instruments that you use to invest, right? On the macro side, there's a macro environment, right? And we saw seen this when we looked at COVID a year ago, or when you look at the deep financial crisis. There are elements that impact exogenous or endogenous events, or usually events, but or things that build up over time that have an impact on the overall market. So there are a lot of people who believe that, particularly if you want to invest in very large size, so if you're an institutional investor, if you're a hedge fund, if you're a pension fund, if you are a very large player that has to put a lot of money into your strategies, you become fairly quickly a person that has a macro view. Macro means that you have a view on currencies, you have a view on the overall economic activity, on liquidity, on individual levels of markets overall. So you start thinking, well, should I be investing in commodities? Should I be investing in energy? Should I be looking at these particular sectors? And then obviously they're instruments. So if you look at the multi-dimensional matrix where you could be putting money, there's, you know, do I put money in Europe? Do I put money in emerging markets? Do I put money in the US markets? Do I do it in equity? Do I do it in fixed income? Do I do it in commodities? Do I look at other particular trends? And this is where it becomes kind of interesting. The macro environment obviously has been, for years now, monetarily loose. So most of everyone has either printed money or done things. These are governments or central banks or institutions that have put a lot of liquidity in the hands of a lot of the people who buy, you know, hold, trade financial assets. And so the macro outlook to somebody in the last 15 years has been, you know, since the financial crisis and since all the work that was done after the financial crisis, to try to make sure that the system had enough capital not to choke on individual problems. Great financial crisis in 2008, 2009. Obviously, COVID in the last 17 months.
Okay, so let's talk about that. Like, if we're going to look at the macroeconomy or the markets in a macro way, what do you think is fundamentally different between the crisis in 2009, 2008, and the crisis with COVID?
So I think going into it, this is a great question. Going into it, I think a lot of the hypotheses, a lot of the rules of the old world still existed. So there was an enormous debate at the time. And remember, there was a change in administration in the United States from the Bush Republican administration to the Obama Democratic administration on how to use the government to try to solve this particular problem. It started during the Republican administration, but basically there was a significant amount of executive desire from people in government to try to resolve a liquidity problem, a problem in the banking system, with all the lessons that had been learned over the years, particularly since, you know, in the 1929 Depression, to try to put a lot of government action into the market. And there was two ways that you can do that. One is monetary, one is fiscal. So the idea is of TARP and some of the systems that they use was to try to inject a lot of money into the system directly, buy equity into the banks, give them a lot of money. On the monetary side, the Federal Reserve, which is supposed to be unaffiliated, but it was part of their overall solution creation, was to buy a lot of assets from the institutions that were under pressure in order to be able to essentially support markets. So the idea was that for years, large banks, large insurance companies, and indirectly pretty much everyone, had invested in certain securities, mostly real estate backed, mostly mortgage securities, mostly derivatives on mortgage securities, that were more and more complex to understand, more and more illiquid, based upon looser and looser credit rules, meaning that people who did not have the ability to purchase things, we're buying things on leverage at fairly high valuations, financed by all this available liquidity, and that those assets, those mortgage bonds, those derivatives, probably had certainly, in a time of crisis, had much less value than what these companies had on their books. And had they been allowed, as they had in 1929 and in other crises around the world in the intervening years, that these assets, if they had been marked to market, if they had been, you know, revalued at what they were probably worth in a crisis, then the overall financial system all across the world would have collapsed, and you would have had a run on the bank, and anybody who thought that they had money at any bank would have shown up asking for the money back, and it would have been an absolute disaster. Because once again, the financial system is I don't want to call it a house of cards, but it's built upon this velocity of money, this multiple use of every dollar out of the ability of the banks and the financial system to create much more activity, financial activity, instruments, money, loans, than there's actually hard money. So the underpinning of the institution of all this financial flow is actually much smaller than all of its application through, you know, all the different lending and capital.
And that's an interesting point, the sense of understanding how fiat money works, which is kind of based on debt. Is that kind of what you're saying?
So
it's based that you're hoping that all that money is going to be paid in the future, but all that money is not there in the now. Is that correct?
That's a fair point. So the capital reserving system that the banks use and it is, you know, that the governments regulate is all about saying that we think that people just want to leave their money in the bank. Whether it's you with your savings account or your checking account or whatever it is, basically there's a bunch of money that's, you know, kind of the savings of the overall system that is kind of meant to be in the banks. And they've allowed the banks and have allowed all the financial participants to make loans against it, which are well in excess of what the actual money that they have on deposit. So there's a multiplier between the number of loans that, say, Bank of America has versus what the on-demand deposits that they hold. And the idea is that it usually squares off in the end. Like when you're lending money to somebody, somebody's depositing it somewhere else or doing something with it. And when things are stable, nobody is running to the bank to ask for the money back. But the truth is that, you know, if, let's say, the Bank of America has lent 100x of something to all of its clients, it probably only has 2 to 3 to 4x of actual cash or value that it can give you if you come to it to ask for your money back. So, and this is common, it happens everywhere. If every customer comes and says, hey, you tell me that I have $10,000 in this bank, I want it now. If everybody were to do it at the same time, pretty much every bank would collapse because it just cannot.
But to that point, there is a certain amount of money that banks need to hold.
Sure.
And that's regulated, right?
So that's regulated, but again, it's regulated at a level which is so small compared to the actual money that they have out there. It's there. And this is why, for example, particularly in the financial crisis, the regulators started introducing things like stress tests, where they've started saying to banks, hey, you know, if tomorrow, by any chance, this class of assets that you have, the loans that you make, which are assets, when you borrow money from a bank, it's a liability to you. You owe the money. But of course, from the bank's point of view, it's an asset. They look at the money that they lend to you as an asset. And the whole idea is, are you a good payer or not a good payer? So the regulators will tell the banks, hey, go out and take your whole portfolio. Assume that every person in the Northeast or in the US or whatever doesn't pay you back, well, pays you back in this particular way, stress tested, which is basically like take, you know, a haircut on the price, take... imagine if that asset that you have was worth less. Now, how much capital do you have left to be solvent, right? And again, there's a difference between solvency and liquidity. Very often, so imagine the simplest of ways, right? You go to the bank, you go and put $10,000 in the bank. That bank then lends it to a company for 5 years, right? Right then and there, you have an imbalance. There's still $10,000 everywhere. Right, so you gave $10,000. The bank is telling you you have $10,000 that they owe you, basically, like your balance is $10,000. Right, but then they've taken the $10,000 actually, like, to be very exact, they've taken 9,700 of it, more or less, and they've lent it out for 5 years. Now, they can't go to that person and say, hey, my customer wants that $10,000 back, give him back the $9,700. Like, that doesn't work. The person has a loan. So the idea is that as long as nobody asks for their money at the same time, it all works because you keep a certain balance. And this is why, for example, checking accounts have a minimum X $1,000 balance and so on, so in order not to have fees or whatever it is. But the idea is that that is insolvency. Sorry, this is illiquidity, right? It's not insolvency. Illiquidity means that I just don't have the money to give you because I have it tied up in somewhere else, but the value is there. This company is a good company. It pays interest. It does all this stuff, which is fine. But on the other side, if a company has invested in a bad, if a bank has invested in a bad company, and that asset probably, instead of being $9,700, is worth $5,000 because the company is doing badly and the people left and maybe they make some product that nobody cares about anymore, right? Then you have an insolvency issue, which means that you owe $10,000 to your customer, but your asset itself is worth only $5,000, right?
Because you put a, like a, you pretty much, you lend the money to the wrong people.
Precisely. And this is exactly what happened in the financial crisis.
That was my question. Exactly. Okay. So it was a problem of solvency.
Well, the problem was
obviously of the liquidity too, but the problem of solvency is what creates a crisis, right?
Well, people will tell you it's a problem of liquidity. 1929 and
well, let's put
2008
it
is closer to a problem of insolvency.
That's my point. You have a problem of insolvency. You have a problem.
You have a massive problem.
Of liquidity. But the point is,
if you're, if you're the Federal Reserve, right, and you're the Secretary of the Treasury and the President of the United States or whomever, and even the President-elect of the United States, right, you're about to inherit all this stuff, and there are, you know, 20 people in a room, 200 people in a room, however one you want to think of that group is now looking at a situation where if they actually agree and say that, yeah, that $10,000 loan is worth $5,000, everything blows up. Everything blows up. Everybody wants their money back. Everybody tries to get their money back. And the next 10 years are in the court system and you go to consult your web page on Bank of America and it doesn't run or it gives you some kind of a nonsense number because it's not a real. So these 200 people, getting together said, well, we can't do that. So what we will do is do a bunch of other things and we'll essentially pretend that this stuff, which is not worth, which is worth $5,000, is worth $9,500, right? Like, we will just, it's again, in the exact same situation, what happens is that the Federal Reserve came to the bank and said, you know what, that company over there that has a bad product that you shouldn't have lent to, which is basically mortgage backed security, now I'll buy it for you for $9,500. So you're going to lose $500. So you're going to lose your profit, but you're not going to die. And now later on, which is very fair, that company over there could actually get better. Because in a crisis, that company's in bad shape. But, you know, given time and so on and so forth, the better economics. And later on, it's possible that we will get our money back. This is what happened with General Motors. I mean, like, you can fault people for having thrown this money at the problem. In many cases, they got their money back. Because it turns out that, yeah, there was a crisis, but ultimately things worked out. But also the choice was, if you didn't do it, you looked at the, you know, in a very bad point. Just to get back on point very quickly. The idea was that going into 2008, people still cared about getting their money back and making loans and how much money. TARP was, I think, $750 billion at the time. And at the time, there were months, you know, TARP failed the first time it went to Congress because they were again spending so much money because everybody was worried about spending too much money. The difference between then and now in the last 15 years, this is why I think of the last 15 years as being so important, is that now nobody cares anymore. Nobody cares. Neither left, neither the right. Pretty much nobody.
There's nobody very cares about what?
About just essentially the printing money for fiscal stimulus or printing money for monetary surplus, but basically the problems are getting resolved by just printing money. And the way that you know that is that the government has to auction, you know, has to raise money. And the way that it raises money, you know, borrow all the money that it needs, is that who's the buyer? It used to be that foreign buyers and savers and everybody else was buying that. And for the last 10 years, basically, rates have been essentially negative, practically negative, certainly in terms of real rates when you compare them to inflation. People buying it are the Federal Reserve. It's the bank from themselves. The person printing the money is buying the debt from the person spending the stimulus, you know, sending the checks and doing the unemployment benefits and doing all that kind of stuff on one side, or itself buying through open market operations tons of liquidity by injecting into the system. So what's happening now is just, since nobody cares, we can print money. And if you print money, it becomes a little bit of a mess, because you and I, having grown up in a system that believes that fiat money, that US dollar money, has value, we're still kind of living in that context. A dollar is still a dollar. You have $1,000 in your bank account, you know what $1,000 buys. But what happens is, by definition, if you have 10, 12 years of this with no end in sight, right? Then what happens is that now it's risky. If the dollar is not worth what the dollar is, the first step of it is inflation. Everybody raises their prices. Because if everybody has money, and if there's money around, then all you do is that $25 haircut is now $30. And at the same time, by the way, labor wages don't rise as much, and the federal wage has not gone up in quite a long time, or is in the middle of going up, but hadn't for a while. So what I'm saying is that you have all these imbalances because there's a lot of uncertainty. As soon as uncertainty about inflation, meaning like I'm making less money but my rent is higher, then I'm in trouble. Now, the one thing that's worked really well is financial assets. If you own debt, and certainly if you own equity over the last 10, 15 years, well, that fractional ownership in a good company like Apple or whatever, you pick one, Chevron, Exxon, whatever is your bag, the fractional ownership has gone up in nominal price for many reasons, including the fact that compared to everything else, it's holding its value. And in order to hold its value, its dollar number has to go up, because the dollar itself is buying less every year. And the whole argument we're having now is that it's buying 2% less, 4% less. Is it transitory? Is it going to go away? Is it not going to go away? That's a whole discussion that's happening now.
So how would you recap or resume in a short phrase the difference between the financial crisis and the 2008 and the one now? It was a banking problem based on solvency and liquidity. And this is more of a known where it's going to go, because we're in the middle.
Yeah, no, this is, I mean, the shocks were different, right? One was self-imposed. Like, what happens is that for years, people bought and sold stuff that got more and more complex, more and more difficult to price properly, and it just blew up in their face. It's a little bit like if the old story of I sell you fish, right? And I sell you back fish for a while, and you're buying fish for trading, and at some particular point you open the box and you realize, well, the fish are rotten by now. There's really no value there. Why did I pay you 10% more than the day before for months and years on end, right? That's 2008. Shock. 2020, obviously COVID, completely different. Like, the government has a public health need to close things down. Let's not get into all that, but it just does that, right? So as a result, not all governments decided, well, if we tell you not to go to work, we're going to have to give you some money. Now, to me, the basic difference that exists between the two is that in 2008, 2009, there was still a debate about what are we doing to the balance sheet? What are we doing fiscally? What is the government doing to the dollar? What are we doing? And I honestly believe that today, not because they're bad actors, not because they're evil, not because they like it, but just slowly, slowly, no one cares. The Federal Reserve balance sheet is open for business. The government is trying to be as strong as it possibly can. It tries to have as much power as it possibly can. So, yeah, in a situation like this, it has a lot of power. It can, you know, send checks. It can send a letter with my name on it, if I'm the president, with my check and make me look good and all that kind of good stuff. And I think that every action has a reaction, right? Like, why did people 12 years ago not just do that? Well, they did not do that because you had people who were older in decision-making positions who decided that, you know, the balance sheet kind of mattered. Like, you know, we care about debt to GDP and deficit and so on and so forth. And then you have one, to me, major issue that is just so evident is when you go to school, they teach you that the risk-free rate is what the U.S. government pays you, number one. And number two...
You're talking about treasuries?
Yes, yes. Okay. The treasury rate, think of it as treasury rate is, you know, at every level, if you invest for 10 years and you want to figure out what is... There's a thing called capital asset pricing model, without getting into all the details, where alpha and beta comes from. And the whole idea is that there's a certain risk-free rate, and whether you're more or less risky than the risk-free rate, you get a certain multiple, and that's how you should think about your risk of return and how much you should earn, right? And so the whole idea is that, mostly because of that, because of this concept that the U.S. government is the riskless, most riskless entity in the world to put your money in, as soon as a financial crisis, people pour money into dollar and pour money into treasuries. That's what they did. And so what happened is in 2008 or last year, all this money goes out of equity, goes out of whatever it is, commodities, equity, you know, whatever it is, and goes into treasury bill. When that happens, the rates go down. When the rates go down, already being pushed down by a very expansionary monetary policy, you get what you get now, which is you put your money in a savings account, you get 0.05% or 5 basis points, right? You get nothing for being a saver in fixed income, lending to the most secure person. Not only that, but in some jurisdictions, in some places, the rates get negative. If you want to lend money to the, if the German government wants to borrow money, you pay them to take your money, you earn no interest. Not only that, but they give you less money at the end of the period. And judging for inflation, you eat all the inflation risk, right? So what happens is that the combination of low rates, which have been stayed low since 2008, because in order to be able to digest the mess that was there, you need to have a lot of liquidity, buy a lot of assets, do a lot of things, right? You fast forward 12 years, what do you find? You find that no sane person is buying treasuries for long-term investment. I mean, some have to do it because that's their job and that's what their mandate is. Sure, fantastic, congratulations. But that is not where you're going to earn return. The risk-free rate is now practically zero. So how do you assess risk? Right? If I mean, in a purely stupid mathematical way, if something is three times more risky than the U.S. government is, you should be getting three times zero. I mean, like, you know, the numbers don't make any sense, right? So now you have things like the high-yield market is trading... The high yield market, let's understand what the high yield market is, right? These are non-investment grade bonds. So a company which is not large enough or not big enough or not successful enough or not worthy enough of being investment grade, which means that Moody's or like the rating agencies give it a good rating, right? Which is where the whole market was for hundreds of years, I mean, for many, many, many years, right? 30 years ago, more or less, was created this other market for smaller companies, right? And those smaller companies always borrowed money at 10 to 15% because it reflected a risk. Like, I want to get paid 10 or 15% annual coupon interest for investing in a company that is of that risk. Now it's 4%. So you're telling me that some company out there that wants to build something which is quite speculative, which is not really proven, they get to raise at 4% simply because Ford Motor Company is able to raise at 1%? I mean, like, this whole risk thing has now changed materially. And so my argument, and this is where, I mean, we'll get to crypto and to Bitcoin, to things like this, is that how long can this last? How long can you have just a system that doesn't really care what the value of the unit of measure is? For years, we knew what a dollar was, more or less. And of course, it went through phases, right? I mean, like, it was pegged to gold and not pegged anymore and all this wonderful thing. But... like, if a dollar that's sitting in your bank account loses 5% a year, we're not there, but we could, because everything goes up by 5%. However, the basket upon which inflation is calculated gets changed. How long do you continue like this, right? And if the dollar loses value, and by the way, this is not the other thing which is fascinating, which is usually people think in currency, right? Like the dollar, the US has certain particular policies that are going to make the dollar go down or the yen go up or whatever it is. But the truth is that this has happened all everywhere. Japan did it 30 years ago when it got into trouble with debt and just flushed the market. And, the Japanese economy has been stuck over leveraged for 20, 30 years now. All these currencies have the same problem. They all managed by governments who have now come to the conclusion that printing money is the way to get out of short-term problems. I understand why they do it. There's no concept. I don't think that they're evil. I don't subscribe to that. And I also think that there's a role for government. But the problem is that right now, we just don't have a system that cares about the unit of measure. Nobody is there defending the value of a dollar because it's become quite impossible. It's a little bit like if you want controlling medical costs, right? By the time that you've put in all the systems in order for there to be runaway inflation, how do you control things that are out of control? You pretend to control them.
Well, you pretend to control it and that's good enough and people believe it, I guess.
You
can survive, right?
Right. People are still negotiating in dollar prices for their salaries, their houses, and everything else. I get that.
Also, it's still to be known if the inflation is going to go that high, because there is a component of inflation which is psychological behavior from business owners, equity owners.
Sure.
If that, for whatever reason, doesn't happen, then
for sure.
I'll be curious, even like printing all this money, if the prices don't rise, I'll be curious to see what do you think is the outcome of that in that hypothetical situation if that happens.
So this is very interesting, because right now inflation is all a discussion. Is it transitory? Is it permanent? Does it happen or not? Right? Fascinating conversation to have. The problem we're having it is we're having it because of COVID. But the truth is that you can go back 10, 15 years to look at the information to try to get a better understanding, I think, of what inflation means, right? So first thing is, you're right. As you were discussing before, there are three elements but let's just talk about three of them for inflation, right? There's a supply chain issue, which is a short-term issue, possibly because of COVID, things got disrupted, things didn't come up online, very high savings rate during COVID, people who want things, used cars, real estate, all that kind of stuff has exploded in that. And that, I agree.
And that could be transitory.
Like, that could be transitory, completely agree.
Let's go. Because
in some ways, if you're making money supplying things, it goes up. The question is whether it's transitory, is whether it pulls up all the component costs, right? Like if the labor at the Porsche factory in Germany skyrockets because they have better negotiation, because they need to work harder, because everybody wants the car, then everything goes up, and that's not particularly good. The second piece, which I mean, to me is the most important one, is the money printing, the loose monetary policy. That one has been a massive piece of it. And the impact of it is unclear, but I'll point to it in a second. And then the third one, which is the one that you discuss, is the expectations of inflation. The problem about inflation is not just inflation that you live with, but as you plan as a business owner, you plan for the future and you look at your pricing and where you think you're going to be and what the problem is, right? So the number of people around here who are raising their prices because it's getting more and more complicated for them to satisfy the demand that they have now or get the employees that they need in order to be able to scale and do all that is absolutely creating inflation. And inflation, by the way, has this bad behavior of not really reverting all that well. So it kind of steps up and maybe slows down, but it never really deflates back to where it was before. Okay. So to me, what's interesting is if I look at the last 12 years, again, this is a hypothesis. I'm not saying I'm right, but this is the way I look at it, right? If for the last 12 years, nobody cares about money printing and everybody is just solving problem, particularly in the last couple of months, last 17 months, in just printing, then what happens is that there are certain things that should be symptoms that you should be able to see. No.
Where's Ava?
Don't know. Bye. Okay, so.
Money printing.
To me, the symptom that you would see in money printing would be who can benefit from, let's say, 12 years of money printing since the last. So who benefits out there, right? Which is fascinating to me. About having very loose monetary policy, tons of money, very easy to borrow if you have a name, right? If you're no one, you can't borrow, but if you're, you know, General Motors or bad example, but you know, Apple, whomever, you can borrow infinite amounts of money for the last 12 years. A favorable, you know, favorable markets. And you look around and that's exactly more or less what happened, right? Financial markets, banks, assets, equities have exploded in the last 12 years. It has been very easy for companies to borrow money very, very cheap, invest into their business without necessarily needing to have high hurdle rates. Like if you're sitting in a company, right?
What's the hurdle rate?
Exactly. If you're sitting inside a company, you have a certain usual hurdle rate of cost of capital, which is that you say to yourself, I want to build a plant in Romania. I want to go and build this new product. I want to go and do this. And at some particular point, outside of the marketing logic of doing this product or operational logic of opening a plant or whatever it is, at some particular point, you do some projections and you try to figure out how much money you're going to make out of that project. And then you look at the cash flows that you think, the profitability, the cost, all that kind of stuff, the inflation of your cost, the inflation of your product price, all that kind of stuff. And then you compare it to a certain cost of capital. And you should, logically, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, 30 years ago, 50 years ago, you would only do capital projects that exceeded your hurdle rate, that exceeded your cost of money. The way it usually works is that internally, you can go, internally, you look at all the capital projects that your managers and your divisions and everybody else is coming to you, this whole process, and, you know, the European head wants to invest in Romania, and this particular person in marketing wants to have a new line of headphones or whatever it is. And you usually have to pick between projects and you pick the ones that are more profitable and you pick the ones that are above what you can borrow or raise money at in the capital markets. Now, let's say that you're a company, and this is all old thinking. People don't think too much in that way anymore, but this is the basis of finance for many, many years. You have a target capitalization, which is that you don't borrow more than a certain amount. So you wouldn't borrow infinite amounts on infinite amount of projects. You want to have some equity in case something bad happens, like COVID or anything like that. So you have, let's say for fun, 50-50 equity. You say that I need to have 50% of equity and 50% debt in my capital structure as a company, which means that, you know, part of it is equity where I had to go and find investors to do it, and part of it I borrowed from the bank. If you can borrow from the bank or from the And if you can bypass the banks, right? If you're a large enough company, you know, a Dow Jones company, an S&P 500 company, and you don't have to go to Bank of America to get money, no need for that. You go directly to bondholders and you offer them bonds directly, which is what, you know, a bond is. Then now you're borrowing at what? 2-4% as a large company? Now, at 2-4% cost of capital, even modified for the equity cost of capital, whatever it is, which because of the P is actually low, doesn't matter. Now many more projects are profitable for you. You know, if you're real estate, many more, you know, higher valuations start making more sense to you. Before, when you had a hurdle rate that was like, say, 10% or something like that, then you would never take a project that was any less than, you know, maybe 12 or 13% in order for you to do something at it. It had to be strategic, it had to do that, but it had to make financial sense. At a lower hurdle rate, the last 12 years have been fantastic for anybody who wants to be a real estate investment trust, a retail company, well, retail, bad example, but, you know, a logistics company, invest in technology, any of that. And you see that there's symptoms everywhere, right? The valuation of technology companies is perfect for that, right? Because technology companies are valued for future cash flows. And future cash flows, people are willing to defer. Amazon has never paid a dividend, and it's a trillion-dollar company. You know, there was a time where discounted cash flow analysis was the way that you would go out and value things like this, and they don't make a whole lot of sense. I'm not saying that Amazon is overvalued. It's not my point. My point is that at this particular point, there's a lot of flux in the units of measure. That a dollar is not necessarily how you want to measure wealth. It's not necessarily the way you want to measure value.
And is that because of the money printing behavior at COVID or even before, or it started at 2008?
Yeah. I think that it the 2008 actions seemed to make a whole lot of sense, but we never recovered from the 2008 actions. We never went back to a normal state. The normal state, I hate to say this because it makes no sense, but it should be that when I go and borrow money for a car, they don't offer me 2%. That doesn't make any sense.
What they should offer you to make sense?
Well, I don't know. The first piece of real estate that I got a mortgage on was, I think, 7.5%, right? I mean, it made you think about buying something. You had to pay 7.5% on the whole value of the thing every year to get the money for it. Now you can get 3% if you're, you know, a good client at somewhere. 3%, you know, you're taking a lot of, by the way, you don't realize, but you're taking a lot of principal risk, which is that if the value of your apartment, your house, or whatever it is, gets destroyed, then you're locked into living in that apartment for a while, for 20, 15 years, 30 years, whatever it is, right? But at the same time, 3% makes it much more affordable for you to own $1 million house, a $5 million house, a car, or whatever it is, right? Because you're just paying a little bit of something. So that is the thing that didn't happen after 2008. 2011, 12, 13, something. At some particular point when we came out of it, you should have had, at that point, essentially, it sounds awful, but a recession, a cooling down, a coming back to somewhat normal, in order to go back to the world of how the world was. Did not happen. I'm not saying I did say earlier it should have happened, but I'm saying, like, if the world had not changed, that's what would have happened. What actually happened is that everybody was like, let's solve our problem with low rates. I can solve a lot of problems with low rates, right? I create other problems which are much more difficult long-term to fix, but I've created them. I'm ignoring them. So problems, for example, nobody saves any money. That's good for the economy. That's good for consumption. You remember?
Lunch is ready. Lunch is ready!
I think that's our cue. Okay, that's a good episode to start with.
Yeah, send it to me.